And we've heard about how the Republican ecosphere, information sphere, is kind of fracturing and coming apart and eating each other. Venezuela does have oil, but you know, there's lots of ways of getting Venezuela's oil. I mean, Maduro has basically offered it up. Chevron, as we speak, is pumping oil and sending it to Port Arthur in Texas to be processed. There's lots of ways to get control. A war with Venezuela over oil is an ideological war, and it's led by the Marco Rubio faction, the war party within the Trump administration, that sees Latin America in very ideological terms, in which Venezuela is the first step to contain a left that, yes, is still strong and still, you know, has quite a purchase. I mean, even in Chile, right, 42% of the population voted for a communist woman in one of the most socially conservative countries in Latin America. That's not nothing. I mean, it's a shame we got the Nazi, but, you know, 42% of the country voted for Jeanette Jara, who is, you know, a communist woman. That speaks, I think, to the strength of the ongoing strength of the left. But there isn't a coherent strategy of how to deal with the United States. I mean, any country going to come to Venezuela's aid to try to get the oil out? I don't think Colombia can risk that. You know, there are ways in which you can imagine Colombia trying to get Venezuela's oil out, but do they want to provoke the United States to that degree? It's a little unclear. So I think everything's up in the air and on the table at this moment. Anything can happen, and I guess things will be clarified by the speech or not.
Well, Greg Grandin, we want to thank you for being with us. Yale University history professor, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His latest book, America, America, A New History of the New World. And we'll link to your piece in the New York Times headline, Trump's Dated Strategy is Putting Us on a Path to World War III. We'll link to you at democracynow.org. Coming up, Chile has elected its most right-wing president since Augusto Pinochet. We'll go to Santiago to speak with the renowned Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman. This is Democracy Now! We'll also later on the broadcast look at the untold story of how Jeffrey Epstein got rich. Back in 30 seconds.
Una canción de amor esta noche. Inesperada para mi voz. Una canción de amor y de goce. Una canción de amor de los dos. Una canción chorubiada. Una canción chorubiada. Una canción chorubiada.
Una canción, a song by the Cuban musician Silvio Rodriguez, performing at New York Central Park years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Chile, looking at the election of José Antonio Kast, who's set to become Chile's most right-wing leader since the U.S.-backed dictator Augusto Pinochet. In Sunday's election, Kast won about 58% of the vote, defeating Jeanette Jara, a member of the Communist Party. She'd served as labor minister under outgoing Chilean President Gabriel Boric, who was not eligible to run for re-election. Kast once praised Pinochet, saying, quote, "If he were alive, he would vote for me," unquote. On Tuesday, Kast traveled to Buenos Aires to meet with Argentina's far-right president, Javier Milei. We go now to Santiago, where we're joined by Ariel Dorfman, the acclaimed Chilean-American novelist, playwright, essayist, academic, and human rights activist, distinguished professor emeritus of literature at Duke University in North Carolina. Ariel Dorfman served as a cultural advisor to Salvador Allende from 1970 to 1973. After the U.S.-backed military coup that installed dictator Augusto Pinochet, Ariel Dorfman fled Chile and went into exile. Today, he's recognized as one of Latin America's greatest writers. His essays, novels, poems, plays have been translated into more than 40 languages. And he has a new article in the New York Times headlined, Chile's election is more than just a swerve to the right. Thanks so much for being with us, Ariel Dorfman. Explain the significance of Chile's election today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Amy. And it's a pleasure to be on Democracy Now, especially when Democracy Now is in such danger in Chile and around the world. There has been, since democracy was restored in 1990, we have had basically center-left governments, except for two occasions, which is of Sebastián Piñera. And Sebastián Piñera twice was elected president, but he could be understood as a moderate conservative. What made it possible for him to be elected in Chile over his 35 years, eight years of the 35 years, is that he voted against Pinochet remaining in power in the referendum of 1988. In that referendum of 1988, a young 22-year-old student called José Antonio Kast appeared on television saying how he adored the general and hoped that he would remain in power forever. Now, that same man, who since then has accumulated a series of more outrageous statements still, is going to be the next president of this country. In other words, a land that got rid of General Pinochet, that danced in the streets when Pinochet died in 2006, that man is now going to be the president of this country. It is a political and ethical earthquake because there are, I mean, I can just go on and on about what this man means. He is going to assault the network that has been constructed not in the last 35 years, but in the last 100 years, the economic and social rights of workers, the indigenous rights. He's against abortion, even if the mother's life is in danger. He's against gay couples, obviously. I could just go on and on and on about this man, whose father, by the way, was a Nazi himself. He was in 1942, joined the Nazi Party as an officer in the Wehrmacht of Germany. And then he, under false papers, arrived in Chile. So it's very strange, you know, because Kast has based his campaign on an anti-immigrant agenda. And according to that agenda, his father would be expelled right now because he arrived undocumented to Santiago.
Well, but Ariel, to what do you attribute the majority of the Chilean people voting for him? And also, to what degree do you think he'll be able to implement that program? He still needs support in the Chilean government as well, among the elected deputies of that country.
So let's go first to your first question, which is, by the way, he won 58%, not 50% of the vote. 58%, which is an enormous majority in Chile, more than 16 points more than Janet Jara, who was his adversary. But the point about this is that the major problems that Chileans constantly are speaking about is too much immigration, enormous amount of crime, though the crime is not linked to immigrants, as the right wing will say. It's mostly Chileans against Chileans, but it doesn't matter. That's their message, and people are buying it. And the problem of affordability. But, you know, Kast would not be able to have this victory, this significant victory, in which a series of people who are not necessarily against democracy want security in their lives. They want somebody strong, like Bukele in El Salvador, in fact, you know, because that's one of the things. Kast has had advisors from Bukele, the Salvadorian despot, to build maximum security prisons here and do away basically with habeas corpus and other forms of democratic institutions. So Kast would not have been able to fill this void if the center-left had not, over many, many years, in some senses, turned its back on the troubles of the people. I want to mention here, because I think I had mentioned this before when I spoke about coming on the program, in my novel, The Suicide Museum, there's a long section, several chapters, on the year 1990. All of it happens in the year 1990, which is the year of the transition from dictatorship to democracy. And I focus on the moment when Allende, Salvador Allende, is taken from his anonymous tomb and given a state funeral in Santiago. I was there. I was part of that. I was living there at the moment. And what called my attention, and I mentioned in the novel, The Suicide Museum, is that the elite was inside the cemetery and in the cathedral where Allende was being buried. But all the people, the young people, the women, the workers, the peasants, the students, everybody who had given their lives and fought for 17 years against Pinochet, those people were left outside. They were even tear gassed, in other words, so, because they wanted also to give a homage to their president, their dead president. The people who had made it possible for Allende to be buried in democracy, for democracy to be returned to Chile, were sort of left out. I found this symbolic. It's not that in 35 years, many good things were not done. You know, poverty was diminished significantly. Infrastructure was major things were done in indigenous rights. Major things were done in sexual rights and reproductive rights. So there have been very, very big advances in that sense. But it's been insufficient. And I think that there is a need for the center-left and the left in general to look very carefully at what blindness or mistakes or fractures they have allowed in the past, and ask themselves what they need to do to reimagine the country in a different way, to think of the country as a different project. You know, I found that one of the things that I found in Chile this last month and a half that we've been here is there's a sense where people are detached. They're uneasy. I call it malestar in my article in today's New York Times. Malestar meaning they don't feel well with themselves. They're a bit sick. They're a bit unhinged. They don't feel that things are going well. And so, of course, they'll say, well, somebody offers us security. They offers us a clear solution, even if it means, you know, getting rid of some democratic institutions. Well, let's be secure at last. Let's not have criminals roaming the streets. I hardly know of anybody who has not had some sort of assault, a criminal assault of some sort. Not all narco-trafficking, but a lot of that, right? So people are fed up with that and tired of that. And the left has not given them a solution. And this is not, I think, only the case in Chile. I think it's the case worldwide. The rise of authoritarianism is only possible because we who want a just and equal society, who do not want to continue with exploitation and super millionaires deciding everything for us, and climate apocalypse, because GAST, of course, is getting rid of all the watchdogs on climate change, right? We want, and we want to make sure that those people who are decent, progressive people, and who are, I think, the great majority, find a way of expressing themselves in something that inspires the people. I don't find my people here inspired. I find them angry, confused, sad, with malestar, with that sense of unease and malaise everywhere almost, right? There's still, you know, there's still a great deal of joy in the people. But I think that in the referendum of 1988, the people of Chile, in the worst circumstances, they managed to defeat the dictator, even if the dictator had. That this is the one where GAST was for Pinochet and Piñera, the moderate conservative, was against him. In that election, the people of Chile rejected that possibility of Pinochet staying in power. And that is why I have some hope as well. I feel as if that joy was demobilized, that struggle, that sense of participation, of protagonism that was possible all during the dictatorship. From 1988, especially until 1990, it was stopped. In some sense, it was said, go home, produce, consume, be happy, and just leave the governing to us, instead of saying, let's continue the mobilization. You know, when Pinochet was commander-in-chief in democracy even, he put his troops on alert because he was being investigated. Instead of calling the people into the streets and saying, we are stopping this country, stop it. You're not in charge of General Pinochet anymore. They said, go home, don't worry, we'll take care of things. So it's been compromise after compromise, and it's been too many. And I think people, therefore, are uninspired, basically. And if you have an uninspired left, an uninspired people, they will tend to, the void will happen in that sense. You know, I have a metaphor for this, by the way. The reason why I think that Cast is in trouble and may be in trouble in the future. First of all, I think he's not going to be able to put into his, he wants to get rid of hundreds of thousands of civil servants because they're parasites, according to his advisors. He wants to deport 330,000 undocumented immigrants. He wants to build a wall, of course. I mean, he wants to finish with all the transgender rights and the gay rights and the women's rights, a series of things. But apart from that, it turns out that he wants to erase the country's history. He wants to get rid of the story of what the coup was about and what the coup engendered. He wants his hero, Pinochet, once again to be venerated by all. He wants to forget the concentration camps and the executions and the torture and the exiles and all the terrible things that have been memorialized in this time. I think that there's a saying, I like this saying, I was thinking of it, I was thinking about Caste, you know. It says, an African proverb says, the axe forgets, but the tree remembers. And I think this is true in Chile. I think the dead of Chile remember. I think the survivors of Pinochet remember. I think many people in Chile remember. I think, I know this is, I mean, I'm a writer, I'm a novelist, I'm a poet. So I think there's a lyrical sense to this, which is, the Cast presidency will be haunted by what it tries to suppress. It will come out from all the trees of Chile. I think Chile is a forest of resistance. We are a minority now for the moment. We are taking our time. It's 42%. It can be more. It doesn't matter how many you are, really. It matters that in the streets, people will not allow a regression of this sort. And if Cast wants to throw the army into this to try to repress the people as happened in the past, because the story of Chile is a story of massacres of peasants and workers and students for 100 years now. If Cast wants to do that, he may find that there is a recalcitrant army. The army already went through the shame of having been the pawn of Pinochet's dictatorship. They do not want it anymore. And when there was the estallido, the explosion of hundreds of thousands of Chileans who were fed up, this time from the left, let's say, right, and almost brought down the government, Piñera, who was then president before Boric, Piñera asked the armed forces to police the streets. And the general in charge of the armed forces says, we are not policemen. That is not what we do. And this is a very big change, right? So let us see what's going to happen as Cast tries to impose a neoliberal model on a country that has, in fact, in the polls, consistently said that it's against so many millionaires having so much money, so much inequality, so much injustice. But people want control over their lives. And they can't have control over their lives if they feel that there's a security threat next door to them and that things will happen which they can't control their own neighborhoods in that sense, right?
Ariel, so we have 20 seconds.
We're up against a very special moment. I'm sorry, yes.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Ariel Dorfman, acclaimed Chilean-American writer. We're going to link to your New York Times op-ed, Chile's election is more than just a swerve to the right. Coming up, scams, schemes, ruthless cons, the untold story of how Jeffrey Epstein got rich. Stay with us.
Yo puedo ser tu hermana, tu hija, Tamara, Pamela o Valentina. Yo puedo ser tu gran amiga, incluso tu compañera de vida. Yo puedo ser tu gran aliada, la que aconseja y la que apaña. Yo puedo ser cualquiera de todas, depende de cómo tú me apodas. Pero no voy a ser la que obedece, porque mi cuerpo me pertenece. Yo decido de mi tiempo, cuando quiero y dónde quiero. Independiente yo nací, independiente decidí. Yo no camino detrás de ti, yo camino de la para aquí. Tú no me vas a humillar, tú no me vas a gritar. Tú no me vas a someter, tú no me vas a callar. Tú no me vas a denigrar, tú no me vas a golpear. Tú no me vas a denigrar.
Anti-patriarca. Anti-patriarchy by the Chilean musician Ana Tijoux, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Friday's the deadline for the Department of Justice to release its investigative files into the dead financier and serial sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. The deadline was set with the passage of the Epstein Transparency Act last month. One of the questions that's remained largely unanswered until now is, how did Jeffrey Epstein become so extravagantly wealthy? Wealth that both enabled his crimes and shielded him from scrutiny and accountability for so many years. Well, a new investigation by the New York Times uncovered details about Epstein's rise, previously unreported, and provides an answer. The investigation's headline, Scams, Schemes, Ruthless Cons, the untold story of how Jeffrey Epstein got rich. This is a video clip featuring some of the reporters. It begins with business reporter Jessica Silver Greenberg.
How did Jeffrey Epstein have the financial backing to abuse what turns out to be hundreds of young women and girls?
The hundreds of millions of dollars that Epstein amassed, the palatial estates and aircraft.
Connections to some of the wealthiest, most established people all over the world. There's been a tremendous number of conspiracy theories and myths.
From he was running a huge blackmail operation to he was affiliated with spy agencies.
Through months of reporting and digging through documents,
people's diaries, letters, old photo albums.
The answer is he stole it.
He stole it. The New York Times investigation begins with Epstein in his early 20s, a college dropout teaching math at the prestigious Dalton High School here in New York. He's introduced by a student's father to Ace Greenberg, the future chief executive of Bear Stearns, an introduction that changed Epstein's life. For more, we're joined by New York Times Deputy Investigations Editor David Enrich, who co-wrote the new piece. We thank you so much for being with us, joining us from Dobbs Ferry. Can you name names, lay out Jeffrey Epstein's rise, the critical importance of the people he connected with, and the lies, the thievery, all that you lay out after, what, months, years of this investigation?
Yeah, we've spent a long time on this one, and it really starts at Bear Stearns, where Epstein is introduced to a guy named Ace Greenberg, who was a top executive at the investment firm. And Greenberg and another of his colleagues, Jimmy Kane, who's also a top executive there, took Epstein under their wings and made him their protege. And Epstein proceeded to go on kind of this spree of wrongdoing at Bear Stearns, everything from abusing his expense account, lying on his resume, giving a girlfriend early access to kind of hot investment deals. And time again, Epstein's protectors at the bank went to bat for him and basically got him out of trouble. And this was the start of a lifelong pattern for Epstein, where he would push the envelope, cross ethical, moral, sometimes legal lines, and basically escape with impunity because of his really astounding ability to charm people in positions of power and to use his leverage over people in positions of power. And one of the things we heard about Bear Stearns was that he was, and this was a time in the late 70s and early 80s where there was a lot of drugs and sex going on within the firm itself. And Epstein, it sounds like, was providing some of the top executives with drugs and with access to women. And so, you know, he had leverage and he was not afraid to use the leverage. And again, we see this over and over and over again in the ensuing decades of Epstein's life and career.
And David, one of the key figures that he cultivated was the Harvard law professor Alan Dershowitz. Could you talk about how they got together and the importance of Dershowitz in his rise?
Yeah, and Dershowitz is interesting because he is both, and he goes on to become Epstein's kind of leading defender and leading protector. But Epstein connects with him through by doing this thing that he does all the time, which is he leverages one connection to form another, to form another. And so in the case of Dershowitz, Epstein in the early 90s had become close with a woman named Lynn Forrester, who was this successful telecom executive who was very close to Bill Clinton and the Clinton White House. Epstein befriends her. She is friends with Dershowitz. And Forrester asks Epstein asks Dershowitz if Epstein can come over and visit him. So Epstein and Dershowitz get together on Martha's Vineyard, and Epstein convinces Dershowitz to fly out to Ohio with Epstein for a birthday party for Les Wexner, who is the billionaire retail tycoon who owns brands like Victoria's Secret. And this is the start of a years-long and very fruitful relationship for both Epstein and Dershowitz. And Dershowitz gets a lot of notoriety and, I think from his perspective, probably fame from his representation of Epstein. And Epstein, for his part, gets this access to a world-class lawyer who engineers a sweetheart deal for him in around 2007 that gets him basically out of trouble when he was facing a sex trafficking and money laundering investigation in Florida. And Dershowitz, and to this day, is one of Epstein's leading public defenders. And so it was an investment that Epstein made in this man in a very kind of prescient way early on. And that entailed not just introducing him to people, but also getting him access to invest in very exclusive hedge funds. And when those investments didn't work out, getting Dershowitz bailed out of those investments. So Epstein was just absolutely masterful at leveraging one connection to benefit another. And, you know, it's often been said that Epstein is this math genius and this super sophisticated financier. What we found in our reporting is much simpler, which is that he may have been those things, but the evidence shows that what made a difference for him in the long run was his ability to charm and entrance and leverage powerful people off of one another.
And if you can talk about the connections, as we're about to see the documents released, if we are, Friday, December 19th, the connections to Trump, to Robert Maxwell, the father of Ghislaine Maxwell, to Ghislaine Maxwell herself serving a 20-year sentence for sex trafficking. Go ahead, David.
Well, and we don't know what's going to be in these files, if indeed there are files released by Friday. And I think it is much more likely, I don't think it's very likely that we're going to see a lot of stuff that kind of plumbs through Epstein's ancient history the way we did in this article. That's part of the reason we wanted to do this reporting, was to provide, kind of shine a light on a phase in his life that has not undergone quite as much scrutiny as his later years. And I think what we're likely to see in these files is quite a bit about him in the 2000s, essentially, and in 2010s. And that happens to be a period where he certainly overlapped with Donald Trump for a period. He overlapped with Bill Clinton for a period. And there are a lot of powerful, important figures kind of darting in and out of his life. And obviously, there is an enormous amount of interest, rightly so, in what these files show, if anything, about how Epstein's sex trafficking operation ensnared some of these kind of bold-faced names. The truth is, and I'm not trying to be coy or evade the question, we just really have no idea what is in these files and what is going to actually be released in a way that is legible. And I think there's an expectation or a concern that these might be very, very heavily redacted if they get released at all. And hopefully I'm wrong about that, because I think the whole world is clamoring for some transparency here. And I, just as someone who's been covering this for like six plus years now with my colleagues at the Times, we are really eager to see what's in these files.
And finally, what surprised you most as you investigated him for all of these years? We just have 30 seconds.
I think what surprised me the most was just how pedestrian some of his scams were. This is not someone who is hatching this like extremely elaborate plot to con sophisticated people through this all these like bells and whistles. He was just grabbing people's money and running with it. And for all of the attention that's been paid to the possibility of Epstein being part of spy services or running this really sophisticated blackmail operation, the truth that we found, and there may be more to it, but what we found was much more run-of-the-mill and kind of low-level than that.
David Enrich, we want to thank you for being with us, Deputy Investigations Editor for The New York Times. We'll link to your new investigation, Scams, Schemes, Ruthless Cons, The Untold Story of How Jeffrey Epstein Got Rich. Happy birthday to Jeff Stauch, and happy belated birthday to Renee Feltz. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Thank you.